This is edition number 2034 of The Mardler, recorded at Aylsham on Friday the 11th of September 2026. Hello, and a warm welcome to The Mardler, the weekly talking newspaper. Just one item from the notice board this week. The sun rises at around 6:45 in the morning and sets at around 8:30 in the evening. Our week's news and views are from the North Norfolk News of Thursday the 10th of September. I am Judith Elliott-Hunter, and my fellow readers are
Jane John,
Robert Watson,
Jane Bradbury.
The magazine supplement, which includes a 200-year anniversary, an extraordinary swim, a fan of Norfolk and a lover of Speedway, follows later. But first, new legislation could see the NHS facility reopen, battle of the supermarkets, Lidl set to oust Aldi in Norfolk's poshest town, picture postcard village in parking permit row as locals are squeezed out. However, we lead with stern opposition mounts against plans for a 550-home development on town outskirts. Objections are mounting over plans for a major housing development that could reshape the future of a coastal town and village. Around 150 objections have been lodged against plans for the 550 homes on the edge of Cromer, despite revised development proposals. The scheme, submitted by Innova Consulting Group, would build homes on agricultural land west of Pine Tree Farm, between Norwich Road, Roughton Road and the railway line. It would also include 192 affordable homes as part of the 550-home bid, a 100-bed care facility, sports pitches for the town's football club and new allotments. The development could increase the area's population by more than 1,600 people. The application was submitted on March the 3rd, 2025, and further information and revised documents were submitted in early December and then again in July 2026. Recent changes include revised footways, crossings and roundabouts. A proposed footway has been widened to 1.8 metres, although earlier plans showed a width of 2.5 metres. The proposed location of an uncontrolled crossing with an extended footway to a bus stop for existing residents has also moved. Tactile paving is proposed for the existing crossing and dropped kerbs will be altered where required. Other transport proposals include a new roundabout on Norwich Road, a reduction in the speed limit from 50 to 30 miles per hour, a 20 miles per hour zone along Roughton Road, traffic calming, upgraded bus stops and improved crossings. However, the changes have not ended opposition. Cromer Town Council remains concerned that narrowing Roughton Road could cause traffic to build up on Norwich Road. It said other sections of the road, including near the mill, are already narrow. One of the many objectors said, "I must ask you to please put the lives of residents first before the wealth of developers." Roughton Parish Council has objected to the development in its entirety. It said land is in the Roughton and North Reps boundary rather than Cromer and claimed the settlement boundary was changed without consultation with its community. The parish council said the proposal would make a mockery of the North Norfolk local plan and create a precedent for other large developments. It also said it would not adopt street lighting at the site, arguing that this would place an unfair cost on other parish residents. Active Travel England continues to raise concerns about the distance between the site and local facilities. It said the application needed a stronger approach to walking and cycling. While it welcomed proposed off-site footway improvements and some cycle infrastructure, it said cycling limitations remained. Norfolk Coast Protected Landscape also maintains concerns about the assessment of the scheme's effect on the countryside. It highlighted potential harm to landscape variety, dark skies, wild areas, biodiversity, and locally distinctive habitats. Natural England said the amended plans were unlikely to have significantly different effects on the natural environment from the original proposal. A council heritage response said surveys had found possible archaeological remains. It requested archaeological work if permission is granted. Locals have raised concerns about congestion, school places, GP capacity, water, sewage, electricity and broadband. Others objected to building on open countryside and agricultural land, citing wildlife, trees, climate change and food security. Norfolk County Council supports an affordable extra care housing scheme, pointing to Cromer's ageing population and lack of such provision. It said 35% of residents are aged 65 or over. The District Council has yet to decide the application. Locals can submit comments before September the 17th consultation deadline and under the reference PO/25/0492.
A disused healthcare site by the Norfolk coast could be brought back into service under a proposed parliamentary amendment. Benjamin Court in Cromer was previously used as a re-ablement centre and has been the focus of a campaign calling for its reopening since its closure. An amendment to the government's health bill has been tabled by Stefan Akerone, MP for North Norfolk. Known as New Clause 124, it would require the Secretary of State of Health to make provision for the site to be used again by an NHS service within 3 months of the legislation becoming law. Mr. Akerone said, "For more than 3 years, people in Cromer have watched this valuable healthcare building sit largely empty, while local campaigners have fought to save it. My amendment would put a clear legal deadline on getting NHS services back into Benjamin Court and require the Health Secretary to come to our community and explain themselves if that does not happen. Benjamin Court should be helping patients again, not sitting unused. The government now has an opportunity to back our community and help bring this long-running saga to an end." The amendment also states that if the deadline is missed, the Secretary of State must attend a public event in the area to explain the delay. Benjamin Court closed in June 2023 without public consultation and was one of two accommodation-based re-ablement units in Norfolk. It provided short-term, bed-based care for people who were not ready to return home after leaving hospital. Norfolk County Council has previously acknowledged ongoing challenges in hospital discharge and patients' flow. Campaigners have called for the return of care services at the site and have held multiple protests for its reopening. The health bill is in its report stage and third reading phase.
The bitter supermarket battle that has divided Norfolk's poshest town is about to reach a verdict. Council planners have recommended that Lidl should be given permission to build a new store in Holt, while rival Aldi's bid should be refused. Both firms have been fighting for the right to open in the town since last year, with each arguing its scheme should win out over the other. Holt, which is known for its Georgian architecture, independent boutiques and tea rooms, has often been dubbed one of Norfolk's most affluent towns. However, the battle between the German retailers led independent retail consultants Nexus to warn North Norfolk District Council that the town centre, anchored by Budgens, cannot survive both stores opening. They warned that trade at Budgens could fall by as much as 30% if both went ahead, with the wider town centre facing a hit of up to 22.6%, figures described by consultants as significantly adverse. This meant that one store alone would not cause the same harm, meaning only one application can be approved. In a twist, council officers have concluded that Aldi's site is actually the better of the two in planning terms. Their report states Old Station Way is closer to the town centre, sits on previously developed land, and is specifically identified as suitable for a food store in the Holt neighbourhood plan. Lidl's Nightjar Road plot, by contrast, is a greenfield site on the edge of town that was never earmarked for retail use. But Oldie's scheme has run into serious opposition from the Norfolk County Council's Highways team over its proposed new access onto the A148 bypass. Highways bosses said the junction would create an unduly complex highway environment and raised alarms over plans for delivery lorries to reverse onto the site, branding the arrangement unacceptable in the interests of road safety. Officers said Aldi could have reverted to a previously approved access route from Old Station Way, but the company indicated it was not willing to do so. Lidl's store, which would sit next to an existing roundabout on the A148, escaped the same level of highways objection, despite the scheme falling 20 parking spaces short of council standards. Officers said the shortfall was not severe enough to justify a refusal and recommended approval subject to conditions. Both firms attracted strong support when they held public consultation. Aldi's application received 117 representations to the council, with 112 in support. Lidl's drew 228 responses, with 186 in support and 32 objections, with concerns focused on traffic, noise and harm to independent traders. Committee members are not obliged to follow officers' recommendations and could still vote to approve, refuse or defer either application. The two applications were due to go before North Norfolk's District Council's Development Committee on Thursday.
Behind a picturesque quayside of delicatessens and seal trips, a row is rumbling in a seaside village over a section of car park reserved for locals, but also, seemingly, contractors' vans. Angry locals have complained to Blakeney Parish Council, saying they can't find a space in the half of the Coronation Car Park off the narrow high street, which has been allotted to them. Some are miffed because the village's council, which hands out permits, also gives them to contractors working on housing association properties in the area in order to prevent their vehicles from clogging up its narrow streets. Others say too many permits are handed out, including to second homeowners, while a limit should be imposed. When a reporter from this newspaper visited, there were a handful of spaces left in both car parks, along with three decorators' vans, a mobile car repair van and its portable shelter, and two seemingly abandoned trailers along the side marked for residents. Victoria Issa, who works in hospitality locally and lives on the high street, said she often struggles to find a space. "The village is just overrun," she said. "As long as you've got a council tax bill for a house, you can get a car parking permit. There's no limit on the number." She added, "People ignoring the double yellow lines and parking on the high street were another bone of contention for locals. Ambulances have had to park at the end of the high street and stretcher people up the road," she said, as a large camper van struggled to weave its way past a car parked on a double yellow line. Vehicle repairer Alex, who said he came from Galston, had put up a gazebo to keep the rain off while he sprayed some crash damage on a BMW in the residence car park, setting up in his van in a space next door. "I can't really speak for anyone else, but this car I'm working on belongs to a resident," he said. "We have to ask whether we have permission to work somewhere before we start, and I've been told we do." A man, who declined to be named, parked in the pay and display side before getting his equipment out of the car
to clean a holiday property. To be honest, I haven't had any problems parking, he said. The neighbourhood here, there's not many properties, and most of the houses around here are holiday lets. One woman, living in a Flint cottage belonging to the Blakeney Neighbourhood Housing Society, which provides more than 30 affordable homes for locals around the village, shrugged and added, "It's been a nightmare for people, but I don't know what the answer is. Maybe they're giving out too many tickets." Residence permits also allow locals to park on the Cansa, a sizeable patch of hard standing beside the harbour, provided they avoid it during high spring tides when parts of it are prone to flooding. "Parking problems? I wasn't aware we had any," said a man, loading his golf clubs into his 4x4 in the Coronation car park. "If there isn't a space here, I just go and park somewhere else." The car park is divided into 30 spaces for residents and 25 pay and display bays, generating nearly £20,000 in income last year. A report to councillors said the wording on permits was clear and the arrangements have been in place for several years, but they have agreed to carry out a review.
A safe place to stay can change the course of a young person's life. That is the message from YMCA Norfolk as it urges people across the county to become supported lodgings hosts, offering 16 to 25-year-olds facing homelessness or family breakdown a secure home and practical support. The charity says hosts are much more than landlords, providing stability, guidance and positive role modelling to help young people gain independence and life skills. A spokesperson for YMCA Norfolk said, "Having a trusted adult and a stable place to call home can transform a young person's future. Supported lodgings hosts play a vital role in helping young people gain confidence, independence and the skills they need to thrive. Supported lodgings is not the same as fostering or renting out a room. Hosts offer a safe place to stay along with help in areas like cooking, budgeting, job searching and managing appointments." One current host said, "I decided to become a supported lodgings host because I wanted to give someone the chance to enjoy the peace and security of a home environment while helping them access local resources and gain the confidence and independence to achieve their goals. It has been a very positive experience having a young person move in, and the YMCA Norfolk team have been excellent with their communication throughout the application process, as well as providing ongoing support to ensure both me and the young person feel happy with the placement. YMCA Norfolk provides comprehensive training, regular supervision and ongoing support from its dedicated supported lodgings team, and hosts also receive a monthly payment. The scheme is open to people from all backgrounds and no previous experience is needed. With demand rising, the charity hopes to recruit more hosts who can offer encouragement and stability to young people at a critical point in their lives. Anyone interested, email supportedlodgings@ymcanorfolk.org or call 07582 014350.
A dream holiday has been ruined after a woman had her savings stolen in a charity shop. Gina Rundle, 56, from Bacton, lost around £600 in cash when her handbag went missing while she was trying on clothes at the East Anglia's Children's Hospice's charity shop in Wroxham. The money had been carefully saved to pay for a holiday. Mrs. Rundle, who is coming up to 15 years all clear from breast cancer, said, "I was frantic with worry, knowing I had lost so much money. Money that I have saved hard, as I'm somebody who has been through something so traumatic. I like to live in the now and give myself nice experiences, and they cost money. She described theft on Saturday, August the 29th, as a violation and said it had impacted her to the point where she had lost her appetite. Mrs. Rundle said, "This person who took my bag has not realised how this has impacted me. It is a lot of stress, which I try to avoid at the best of times, and I'm exhausted, and it has taken it out of me. They don't realise how it affects somebody. They see the money, and that's it. They don't notice the impact on the individual you have taken from." She said she would not take the matter further if the money was returned anonymously. Fran Elliott, head of regional operations at Each, said, "We are so very sorry to hear about this incident and appreciate how upsetting it must be for Gina. Our team did everything they could to assist and support her when the loss was first reported, and we remain willing to help in any way we can." Norfolk Police said the theft was reported at 1:31 p.m. on Saturday, August the 29th. "Anyone with information is asked to contact the police, quoting Crime Reference 250 of August the 29th.
A refurbished kitchen that supports older people and provides meals to North Norfolk towns and villages has opened. Sheringham Day Services' new kitchen was officially opened during a visit by North Norfolk MP Steph Acheron on Saturday, which was International Day of Charity. Mr. Acheron met clients, staff and trustees and saw how the centre supports older people in the local community. The service also prepares and delivers meals to people in nearby towns and villages. A spokesman for the kitchen said, "From this kitchen we provide freshly cooked lunches for our clients and deliver up to 40 meals daily in the local towns and villages. The centre is open from Tuesday to Friday and provides a place for people to meet, take part in activities and maintain social contact. Activities include arts and crafts, gentle exercise classes, quizzes, board games and music. Support workers have dementia training and provide additional assistance to clients. The centre aims to help people remain independent, continue living at home and take part in community life. The Meals on Wheels service operates on the same day as the centre. It provides a 2-course meal delivered to the door for £7.50. Liz Withington, North Norfolk District Councillor, attended the official opening. Ms. Withington said on a social media post, "Thank you to all the amazing staff, trustees, volunteers and everyone who donated or raised funds for this fabulous new kitchen, providing meals locally and the surrounding area." She said the event was enjoyed by service users and gave visitors a chance to see the activities available at the centre. Mr. Acheron also highlighted the need for volunteer drivers to deliver meals to people in the community. He said, "Providing somebody with regular support, company and a bit of practical help can make an enormous difference to their quality of life. It can also help people remain in their own homes for longer rather than reaching the point where residential care becomes necessary. The centre also offers opportunities for social activities, including visits from local choirs, school children and therapy animals."
A major new car park could soon be built in one of Norfolk's biggest seaside resorts. North Norfolk District Council's Cabinet will be asked on Monday to support plans for the new facility in Cromer. The 44-space pay and display car park would replace the town's former tennis courts and children's play area in North Lodge Park, which has been unused for more than 20 years. A consultation carried out by the council last year found 44.2% of 788 respondents backed a car park, ahead of 39.8% who wanted the space kept for community use and 14.1% who supported commercial use. Council papers show £250,000 has already been set aside for the scheme in the capital programme, with 13,032 spent so far this year. NNDC made 2,740,448 from its car parks in 2024, and it represents one of the authority's largest money makers. The highest grossing car park was the 265-space Cromer Meadow, which brought in £395,543. The council is hoping the new site will provide better parking to the east of the town centre, where officers say off-street parking is limited and on-street parking on residential streets is an increasing problem. The council held a similar consultation in 2016. However, residents were firmly against the plans at the time, with 628 of 799 respondents, 79%, opposed to a car park on the site. The Cabinet has been recommended to approve the recommendation. It will then be put forward to full council on September the 23rd.
A textile project celebrating community well-being is coming to Munsley Library. Love is the Thread, organised by The Cloth of Kindness, is set to run from September the 22nd until the end of November. The project is led by textile artists Sally Ann Lomas and Jill Perks in collaboration with Norfolk Libraries. The initiative is inspired by the textiles crafted by Lorimer Bulwer in the Great Yarmouth Workhouse at the end of the 19th century. It aims to delve into memories, local and family history, while also imparting skills such as stitching words and textile collaging. The project will comprise a series of workshops dubbed Sewing Socials, which are open to everyone regardless of their sewing abilities. The organisers welcome both novices and experienced stitchers, aiming to create a friendly and relaxing environment where participants can learn new skills and share their talents. The ultimate goal of the project is to create a beautiful piece of textile art to be displayed in the library, celebrating the local community. The workshops will be held on Tuesdays from 1:30pm to 3pm with all the necessary equipment and materials provided.
A North Norfolk fitness instructor is hoping to get more women moving to music with her outdoor silent disco walking sessions. Emma Staples, who runs Body Blitz Fitness, launched the Norfolk version of her Walk Fit silent disco sessions in January 2025 after moving to the area from Kent. Participants wear wireless headphones while walking, exercising and dancing outdoors, with sessions taking place in places including Cromer and Munsley. Miss Staple said that the events had grown into more than a fitness activity, bringing together women for fresh air, music and friendship. She said the groups have danced along seafronts, through town streets and on Cromer Pier, sometimes leaving passers-by curious about what they're listening to. Body Blitz said its first Norwich Walk Fit Silent Disco event attracted 40 bookings and a waiting list, with quarterly sessions now planned in the city alongside North Norfolk dates. Miss Staples said videos from the session had also attracted up to 100,000 views on social media.
A beloved family cat is back on his paws after surviving a suspected gunshot wound and surgery. Morris, a ginger rescue cat from Clye, was found by his owner, Stuart Banks, with a severely injured leg and was rushed to an emergency vet where the limb was amputated. Mr. Banks said it was really quite horrific. The injury was later found to be consistent with a gunshot wound and has been recorded by police as a wildlife crime. Despite the trauma, Morris has made a remarkable recovery and has now been officially discharged by the vet. He's adapted amazingly to life on three legs and is back enjoying life, which is more than we could have hoped for when he was rushed into surgery, Mr. Banks added. The family, who had believed Morris was insured, have been left to cover the full £4,777 veterinary bill. A fundraiser has raised £2,466 so far, but donations have slowed and the family remain some distance from meeting the full cost of his care. Mr. Banks said, "The kindness of our local community has been overwhelming and it means more to our family than we can put into words. To donate, go to www.gofundme.com/F/give Morris the chance to thrive on three legs.
Haysborough RNLI is inviting people to hear about the vital work of its lifeboat crew. The An Audience with the Crew event will take place at Cart Gap Lifeboat Station on Tuesday, September the 15th. Hosted by Anglia News presenter David Whiteley, the event will feature stories and anecdotes from long-serving and current crew members, volunteers and lifeguards. Attendees will hear about everyday bravery, selfless courage and the training that goes into saving lives at sea. A spokesman for the RNLI said, "This will be a unique event hosted by Anglia News presenter David Whiteley to hear real stories and anecdotes from long-serving crew members and current crew and other volunteers and lifeguards. Doors open at 7 p.m. for a 7:30 p.m. start. Although the event is free, booking is recommended and can be done via norfolkhods.ticketsolve.com until Monday, September the 14th at 3 p.m. Light refreshments will be available for a donation. Limited walk-in places may be available."
A choir will perform James Bond themes in an up-and-coming concert. Choir Worsted is set to perform a range of music from films, including James Bond themes, at two concerts in October. The music will also take you to New York, aboard the Titanic, and all the way to St. Louis, with tunes like The Trolley Song, The Lady is a Tramp, My Heart Will Go On, New York, New York, and more. The first show is on Saturday, October the 3rd at 7:30 at Worsted Village Hall, with a cabaret-style setup and bar. The second is on Sunday, October the 4th at 3 p.m. at North Walsham Community Centre, with refreshments available. The choir will be joined by their regular pianist, Matthew Bond, and guest musicians on flute, saxophone, clarinet, and string, bass guitar. Musical director Adrian Connell said, "Our musicals concert was a sellout, and we are hoping to see some familiar and new faces to our latest dates. Tickets for the concert cost £12, plus booking fee online, with concessions available at www.ticketsource.co.uk/the-choir-worsted.
A boatyard in North Norfolk received a royal visitor at the weekend. On Saturday, the Princess Royal, Princess Anne, went to the Broadland Youth Regatta at Barton Broad near Neatishead. The event was hosted by the Punt Club, which is celebrating its 100th anniversary. The regatta saw 134 competitors and 108 boats in the youth teams from sailing clubs across Norfolk battle it out on the water. As part of her visit, she stopped at Cox's Boatyard in Barton Turf, which offers boat restoration and repair. A spokesman for the boatyard said, "We were delighted to welcome Her Royal Highness the Princess Royal, Princess Anne, to Cox's Boatyard. It was a real honour to showcase the boatyard and our skills, keeping boat building and restoration alive in Norfolk." Princess Anne took the time to meet some of the young members of the Keem and to hear about the work they do at Cox's Boatyard. She then went out onto Barton Broad on board one of Nancy Oldfield's Trust's boats to view and talk to the young competitors sailing in the Broadland Youth Regatta.
A search and rescue team in Norfolk had one of its busiest months on record. Norfolk Lowland Search and Rescue was called to 7 incidents in August alone. This brought the total call-outs for 2026 so far to 32, surpassing the entire total for 2025 by 1 incident. In August 2025, the team was called to 3 incidents. The call-outs involved searches for high-risk missing persons in Dereham and Lenwade, which both lasted for multiple days. The team was also called to assist in a search in the Helsden Mill area, where the water and underwater team were deployed. The organisation, run entirely by volunteers, is calling for support to ensure it remains ready to respond to emergencies. A spokesman for Norfolk Lowland Search and Rescue said, "We're coming off the back of one of our busiest months on record, with our volunteers working hard to support people across Norfolk when they needed us most. We're run entirely by volunteers, and your support helps us keep our team trained, vehicles maintained, boats operational, and specialist equipment ready to go. It has appealed for fundraising, volunteers, connections with local businesses, and donations to help maintain its operations."
More than 100 vehicles are returning to one of the county's most popular classic car festivals. The Reepham Classic Car Festival will take place in the town centre on Sunday, September the 27th, from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m, marking its 10th show since launching in 2014. The event has become a favourite among families and motor enthusiasts, filling Reepham Marketplace with vehicles spanning decades. Tom Hills, one of the organisers, said, "The market square limits the number of cars we can have, so I can't promise bigger, but we have been booked up for months now, so it's certainly popular." This year's festival will feature 110 cars from pre-war through to around the turn of the century, with American, British and European and even Japanese cars on show. As before, we'll have the local cafes open to the public, plus artisan ice cream, coffee and hog roasts, Mr. Hills added. If anybody wants to get involved on the day, we're always looking for marshals to help out. So contact us on reaphamcarfestival@outlook.com.
At least 200 children and young people took part in this year's Beach Life Outreach in Sheringham. The 4-day Christian event, themed around hope, ran from Monday, August the 24th to Thursday, August the 27th and offered a packed programme of fun, games and faith exploration on the clifftops and beach. Sheringham's mayor judged sand sculptures at the event. Peter Skivington, planning group leader, said, "It was fantastic once again to partner in sharing the gospel with so many children, young people and families. Let's pray that they remember the fun they have had learning about Jesus this week and that what they discovered about him impacts their lives." At least 200 children and young people attended one or more activities, with many parents and family members joining in the afternoon and evening sessions. Mornings began on the Lees with the Beach Special, featuring songs, challenges, drama and the ever-popular Gunge Tank. Participants then split into age groups for Going Deeper sessions, exploring the daily theme through creative and engaging activities. Stories included Jesus healing a paralysed man, calming a storm, raising Lazarus and appearing on the road to Emmaus. Afternoon events featured beach games, a tide fight and a family picnic at St Peter's Church. Evening activities included putting on the Beeston Hill Green, Swimming at the Reef, and the return of Sheropoli Youth Trail. All events were free to attend. Beach Life is organised by Sheringham Churches and supported by more than 70 volunteers. Funding came from the Sheringham Paws and Plowlet Trust, the Diocese of Norwich and individual donors. Feedback on the Beach Life Facebook page was positive. One parent, Bryony, said on Facebook, "It's been a truly wonderful few days and my son has so enjoyed it. Thank you all for your hard work and dedication. He's been singing the songs non-stop."
A Norfolk church has launched a crowdfunding appeal, backed by the designer Emma Bridgewater, to save its unique windows, which could collapse without urgent repairs. St Mary's Church at Wifton, near Holt, hopes to raise £25,000 by the beginning of November for the first phase of the work. Without your support, some of these windows will fall out and we will be forced to have them blocked up, which will mean a part of history will be gone forever, the appeal page says. Please give what you can, in the knowledge that all donations, large or small, are so gratefully received. The appeal on the crowdfunder platform has so far raised £13,560. It is part of a wider £500,000 restoration project, which also includes replacing guttering and soakaways on the nave that have not been updated since at least Victorian times. Ceramic designer Dame Emma, who lives nearby, described the church as a massive community asset, which was at risk of damage from water entering the building. On a video on the appeal page, she added, "Please, please, will you have a think about how much you'd miss this church if it wasn't here, and dig deep." The church, next to a former medieval port, was built largely in the 15th century. As well as medieval graffiti, its features include a historic Holdrich organ built for the Great Exhibition in 1851 and one of the few remaining examples in the country. The organ, which was restored 20 years ago, now has to be covered by a tarpaulin to prevent it from water damage. Friends of Wifton Church has raised many thousands of pounds for the preservation of the building. In the summer of 2019, a roof timber collapsed in the chancel, and the group secured the £200,000 required to carry out repairs.
The trial of a new machine to help get Norfolk's pothole-pocked roads fixed has begun, with officials and councillors keen to establish if the technology will save time and taxpayers' money. Reform-led Norfolk County Council is testing out a specialist JCB Pothole Pro machine, with the vehicle and the operator provided to County Hall at no cost during the trial. The machine is being tested at Fircovert Road and Cherry Tree Road near New Buckenham in South Norfolk, while a further test is planned at the B1145 near Corston in North Norfolk. Council officials will evaluate how effective the machine is before deciding whether or not to sign a contract for one or more of them in the future. Alan Wallace, National Highways Manager for JCB, said the machine could cut, crop and clean potholes more quickly and safely than traditional methods, before other workers complete the job by resurfacing the prepared area. He said, "We are confident in the machine's capabilities and are demonstrating it so the council can see the benefits it can bring. Rather than have five or six workers out there with breakers, this machine can do the job of breaking, planning and sweeping. We did a test in Stoke-on-Trent where we compared it to a conventional team. That team took an hour and a half to do work, which this machine completed in 13 minutes. Graham Bygrave, Director of Highways, Transport and Waste at Norfolk County Council, said, "Not all roads are the same from the construction point of view, so the idea is to see how the machine operates on Norfolk's roads and how it copes. At the end of the trials, we will carry out a full evaluation comparing it to the other methods which we use."
National Trust locations across Norfolk are offering visitors the chance to explore the hidden stories behind their sites. Heritage Open Days are returning from September the 11th to the 20th, with free access to experiences and events at Felbrigg Hall and the Blickling Estate. At Felbrigg Hall, visitors can join special attics and cellars tours on September the 17th and 18th. These tours, which can be booked for free, reveal the lesser-known stories of the estate and the families who lived there. Garden enthusiasts can take part in guided walks through the West Gardens on September the 15th and 17th. At the Blickling Estate, the Textile Conservation Studio will host a free exhibition in the loft from September the 14th to the 20th, open daily from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. The display marks 50 years of the studio's work preserving historic textiles from National Trust properties across England, Wales and Northern Ireland. It charts the studio's development from its volunteer-led beginnings to an internationally recognised centre of conservation. Visitors will learn about the evolving techniques and skills behind textile conservation and meet the experts who care for these collections. No booking is required for the exhibition.
You are listening to edition number 2034 of The Mardler, recorded on Friday the 11th of September 2026. We have articles about a baker's retirement, two newlyweds' unexpected dip, an author's upcoming talk, and praise for Sheringham Station, plus The Mardler magazine supplement. But as there are no obituaries or letters to the editor this week, we next have details of some What's On events.
Forthcoming events include, on Saturday 19th of September, Overstrand Family Food and Drink Festival, 11:30 a.m. to 7 p.m. at Overstrand Sports Ground. Free admission for delicious dishes, artisan produce market, music, games and entertainment. Also on Saturday the 19th of September, a harvest festival at St Mary's Tunstead. A fun-filled family Thanksgiving of all things rural from midday, culminating in a service at 3 p.m. Free entry. There'll be lots to see and do, from a barbecue, tractor display and raffle, to children's activities. The whole family is invited, including your pets. Whether you walk, trot or hop along to see us, refreshments, fun and a warm welcome await you.
We turn now to this week's Mardler magazine supplement. We include An Extraordinary Swim, Joe Pasquale's Life in Norfolk, and Mike's Love of Speedway, but first, making a comeback 200 years after it first opened. Following the valley of the River Ant and running for almost 9 miles between Antingham, northwest of North Walsham, and Smallbridge Junction, west of Stalham, is perhaps Norfolk's most unexpected industrial feature, a canal. The North Walsham and Dillham Canal is the county's only locked wherry sailing canal, and this year it celebrates its 200th anniversary. Mostly disused since the late 1930s, with sections dry and choked with vegetation, in 2008 the North Walsham and Dillham Canal Trust was set up to continue the restoration, conservation, protection and improvement of the physical and natural environment of the canal, started by the East Anglian Waterways Association Limited in 2000. Since then, a group of volunteers have carried out work for the benefit of people and nature, not just rewatering it to make it navigable by light craft, but repairing the crumbling infrastructure of locks, spillways and backsoaks. Our charity's strategy and mission is aimed at the restoration and maintenance of the waterway navigation, structures and environs for the appropriate leisure use and wildlife, explains Sue Kirridge, chair of the North Walsham and Dillam Canal Trust. Research has proven that canals are healthy places for people if restored mindfully, creating biodiversity where wildlife and communities thrive. The canal is privately owned by four sets of owners, and the Trust is undertaking unique work in supporting them with an emphasis on conservation and restoration. Examples of infrastructure we have engaged in include the clearing of the mill pond at Ebridge, the renovation of Bacton Wood Mill Lock, Ebridge Lock and Royston and Ebridge Spillways, Honing Staithe, Purdy's Marsh and replacement of lock gates. It was the difficulty of navigating many shallow, narrow, meandering loops in the River Ant that inspired the building of the canal to act as a new cut to connect the wider stretches of the river and the nearby broads for the transportation and goods for both the local community and seven mills in the area. The canal was built quickly by 100 navvies beginning in 1825 and opening in 1826. Smaller wherries were specially designed for the new watercourse, and the canal featured six locks and eight bridges. Corn, flour, timber, cattle cake and fertilisers from Antingham Bone Mills were important cargo. However, the arrival of the railway began the canal's decline. Some wherries converted to pleasure craft in the later 1800s, but all trade fell away. By 1931, only the wherry Ella was left trading. She last sailed the canal in 1934. The canal remained mainly dormant until the year 2000, when restoration began uncovering work that needed doing. Laurie Ashton was responsible, with support by the volunteers, for opening up the navigation in pounds, or bodies of water, 4 and 5 of the canal. Our priority work is to restore or conserve, as appropriate, the waterway, spillways, backsoaks and locks, as the heritage aspect is very important, says Sue. Currently, there are 5 sections that are in water, 3 of which aren't navigable and 1 dry section. The presence of otters shows the canal is healthy and teeming with fish, but we can't unilaterally make plans to rewater the dry section, although we look forward to supporting the owners' work in this. In 2018, the NWDCT became a charitable trust, which made it possible to apply for larger grants, for example, to purchase lock gates and work pontoons. The Trust has 30 dedicated volunteers who join in with what they are interested in. Many are out in all weathers, involved in managing vegetation, weed, fallen trees, tackling invasive species or working on a restoration project, and they are known fondly as the muddy ones. Then they are the wet ones, on work pontoons, out on the water or on boat trips, the green ones, wildlife, fishing and environmental folk, and the suited ones who also work indoors in organisation and administration. The Trust has the ability to plan projects and bring in expertise when needed, or use skills from among the volunteers. However, for Bacton Wood Mill Lock, Laurie Ashton manufactured both the top and bottom gates in a workshop that he built specifically for the job. They were then installed by Trust volunteers. Other gates will need to be purchased, traditionally made of oak, but these are the jam on a scone, says Sue. It is essential to ensure that the lock walls are sound and to secure brickwork first. At Bacton Wood Mill Lock, these were rebuilt by Laurie Ashton and a bricklayer friend of his. At the top section, above Swayfield, there is conservation work on lock walls and environs. For this to be possible, vegetation that invades and harms structures must be stripped away. We are delighted to say that kingfishers are nesting all along the canal, and all this is made possible through the generosity of businesses, groups and the public. Today, the canal corridor is a far healthier, rejuvenated and the Trust appreciates donations, including from Tranquil Pleasure Cruisers on a member's replica wherry. You can book trips at £1 Dillam at the bottom end leading out to the Smallborough River and then the Ant. This section is peaceful and used by paddleboards and kayaks and was the site of the Trust's 200th Anniversary Canal Festival on the 29th of August and 30th. That article by Serena Shores appeared in the September 2026 issue of the Norfolk Magazine.
Next, Lincolnshire to North Norfolk, an extraordinary feat. In June 1929, Mercedes Glytz became the first person to swim across the Wash, from Lincolnshire to the North Norfolk coast. Her achievement in battling her way through the notoriously difficult tidal currents of the Wash was heralded as an extraordinary feat of endurance at the time, and no other swimmer would repeat her success until the early 1970s. This proved to be just one of many notable successes achieved by this remarkable female pioneer of endurance swimming. Born in 1900 to German parents, Mercedes spent a good deal of her childhood on the south coast in Brighton and Hove. She learnt to swim at school, where she won her first and only race. That was in 1914, and until 1922, I was never in the water again, she later recalled. By the time she did take up open water swimming seriously, in early adulthood, the contest to become the first woman to swim the Channel unaided was in full swing. Only a handful of plucky male swimmers had ever made the arduous crossing without the help of buoyancy aids or specially designed rubber suits. Mercedes did not have the same level of financial backing or experience as many of her female competitors, but she became determined to make her own bid for swimming immortality. She was working as a secretary in London when she first tried to swim the English Channel in the summer of 1922. Described by one newspaper as quite a small, almost frail girl, Mercedes only managed 6 miles before she was compelled to abandon the attempt. Undeterred, she tried several times over the following 5 years before finally achieving her goal at the 8th attempt in 1927. By this stage, an American named Gertrude Adelaide had beaten her to the accolade of becoming the first female swimmer to cross the Channel. Nevertheless, as the first British woman to complete the feat, Mercedes attracted a lot of media attention. Within days of her record-breaking swim, the Sunday Express reported that she had already received several proposals of marriage by letter, as well as scores of letters and telegrams from admirers. Soon afterwards, the intrepid young Brighton woman achieved another notable first when she became the first swimmer of either sex to cross the Strait of Gibraltar, still considered one of the world's most challenging open water swims today. In May 1928, Mercedes was invited to open Hunstanton's new seawater bathing pool and used the opportunity to declare her intention of becoming the first person to swim across the Wash. On hearing this, one newspaper reporter remarked that she had a reputation for swimming odd stretches of water which have not been swum before, a comment which took little account of the considerable risks involved in undertaking such a challenge. The prospect of battling against the notoriously strong and unpredictable tidal currents of the Wash had proved daunting for many an experienced competitor before her. Back in 1910, the Skegness Recreation Committee had offered a gold medal and a cash prize of £20, then a considerable sum, to the first person who successfully swam across the Wash, only to have to cancel the contest because of a lack of volunteers. In contrast, Mercedes welcomed the opportunity to test herself, although she was unable to fulfil her promise for over a year. Even then, she had to wait for several weeks until the prevailing weather conditions offered her the best opportunity of success. Eventually, at 5:10 a.m. on June the 20th, 1929, she set out for Hunstanton from the Lincolnshire coastal village of Butterwick, after reportedly enjoying a breakfast of fried fish, coffee, and bread and butter. As was customary for anyone attempting such a feat of endurance, she was accompanied by a support team on a pilot boat. Their presence proved invaluable during a swim which transpired to be more grueling than she could possibly have imagined. Having set off in ideal conditions, the wind strengthened as the day progressed and the sea became very choppy. At one point, she experienced such difficulty in battling against the strong tidal currents that she made little headway for over 4 hours. In the end, the current was such that she ended up coming ashore 3 miles down the coast from Hunstanton, at Heacham. She had been in the water for over 13 hours and scarcely had the energy to drag her weary body onto the beach. Undeterred, she soon declared herself fit to attend the pre-planned official reception at the Golden Lion Hotel in Hunstanton. Over the course of the following 4 years, Mercedes continued to break endurance swimming records across the world. Such was the public interest in her record-breaking feats that she became one of the era's most remarkable female sporting stars, notably as a brand ambassador for the Rolex Oyster waterproof watch and for Lipton Tea. She also used her celebrity status to establish a charitable foundation to help the homeless and opened the Mercedes Glites Home in Leicester. After 10 years, Mercedes retired from swimming to start a family with her husband, Patrick Carey. She never courted publicity again, and her exploits had been largely forgotten by the time of her death, aged 80, in 1981. Thankfully, in recent years, her legacy of one of endurance swimming's most influential figures has finally come to be properly recognised. That article, by Margaret Brecknell, from the Norfolk Magazine, August the 2026 issue.
And now, every day above ground is a good day. Joe Pasquale has half an eye on the clock. There's a live radio slot looming, another interview to squeeze in, and later he'll be back on the road again. Yet down the phone, he sounds exactly as you'd expect. He's chatty, oh so chatty, genuinely warm, quick-fired, and just a bit daft, his trademark chuckle never far away. He's nattering to me ahead of his return to one of his hometown theatres, The Orchard in Dartford, where he'll be back on Panto Day this Christmas in Cinderella. But Norfolk audience know him just as well. Joe is no stranger to the county, having performed regularly at its theatres and holiday parks over the years, and he lived in Hopton-on-Sea earlier in his life. These days, he's back living in Norfolk again, and there's a strong family connection too. His son, Joe Tercini, has become a much-loved regular in Norwich's Theatre Royal's pantomime. Cinderella marks a double milestone for Joe, his first pantomime in a decade and his 40th year in the business of He's Behind You. For years, Cinderella has meant one thing for Joe, playing Buttons, the lovelorn sidekick. This year, at 65, he's graduating to Baron Hardup. It's my 40th year in panto, and I'm playing Baron Hardup for the first time, he says. I'd normally be playing Buttons, but I'm 65 this year, and it gets a little bit weird when Buttons is there with Cinderella, who's 21. I love you, Cinderella, he laughs. It's a little bit weird now, especially in the day and age we live in, so I'm playing her dad this year. There's no script yet. I can't really give you that sort of information, but he's relishing the chance to do something different. It'll be a good change for me, so I'm very excited to show something completely different. Though he's long been claimed by Kent, he spent the best part of 30 years living in Rochester, Joe is at heart an Essex lad. "Yeah, I'm a Grays boy," he says proudly. He has vivid memories of growing up on the Thames. His dad used to take him to the Wharf, he calls it the Wharf, pub at Grays Beach, back in the days when children weren't allowed in the bar. "He'd take me down there and go and play dominoes and darts. In those days, kids weren't allowed in the pub. And he would let me play on the beach, if you can call it a beach, in the mud and in the space. But there's no sand at Grays Beach." Joe would be left on his own devices for long hours, hunting for old clay pipes in the mud. "Dad would go in there for hours and come out, give me a packet of cheese and onion crisps with a bottle of Coke, and then come back 3 hours later, and there I'd be, covered in mud, looking for a clay pipe." He knows you couldn't do that now. Imagine leaving a kid on Grays Beach for 3 or 4 hours. But he's grateful for the freedom he had. It's part of why he believes so strongly in the magic of pantomime. For Joe, panto isn't just seasonal work. It's an essential introduction to live theatre. It's the first time that kids get to be part of a live audience and interact with people on stage and express themselves by shouting and screaming at the characters, he muses. In a world of screens and headphones, he thinks that matters more than ever. Kids are so bogged down with computers and iPads that this is the first time, if you get them hooked at this age as the theatre-goer, they'll be a theatre-goer all their life, which is why I think panto is important. He sees it as a rare, shared experience. It's the time of year that brings all the families together. It brings all age groups together. The little kids, the middle-aged kids, the older kids, and then the grannies and granddads, and the mums and dads. That's the thing that starts the bond over Christmas, I think. Anyone who has seen Joe on stage knows he doesn't stand still for long. Panto, he says, is a marathon, not a jolly runaround. "I am 65 this year, but I do go to the gym every day," he says. That's the whole thing with panto, it's a marathon. People think, oh, it's going to be fantastic, but by the end of the first week, they're absolutely knackered. Audiences might only come once, he points out, so the last show has to feel as sharp as the first. If they come at the beginning, they see a great show. If they come at the end, they deserve the same show. It's no good walking out after a month going, oh, I'm so tired now. To keep going, he's strict with himself. Early nights, decent food, no late-night drinking when there are 2 shows the next day, 3 on Saturday. You really have to look after yourself, he says. Away from the spotlight, Joe's life in Norfolk would probably surprise anyone who only knows the squeaky-voiced comic from the telly. "I've got a pilot's license," he says, matter-of-factly. "Every chance I get, I'll go and fly a plane. I'll rent a plane and go and take that out. Nobody will come with me." When he lived in Kent, he often flew from Rochester. Now he'll head to Norwich or all sorts of different places nearer his new home in Norfolk, where he moved after COVID. The move to a new county has been a change. "It's a huge difference," he says, of the change in pace. "But I don't have to deal with the Dartford Tunnel every day. That's a bonus, isn't it?" He's also a big motorbike person and has taken open university degrees in geoscience. He paints when he can and has discovered a genuine love of cooking. "I'm really good at pastry," he says, delighted. "I've learned how to bake cakes as well. I'm great at bolognese. I'm great at pasta. I'm very good at making my own bread as well. Cooking is a real highlight for me. Friends don't go hungry. I'm a bit of a feeder. Someone comes round and they say, I can't eat all that. Well, you're going to have to, I say. I've made it." During panto season, he'll always try to base himself in an Airbnb so he can cook rather than relying on hotel food. If you go to a hotel, then you're at the mercy of whatever they're putting on a plate for you. If there's a thread that links the aerial adventures, motorbikes, degrees and new recipes, it's his appetite for risk. "I realised a long time ago that I'm completely fearless. There's nothing that I won't do. If I can't do it, I'll go and learn how to do it." A book, Susan Jeffers' Feel the Fear and Do It Anyway, crystallised that mindset. It teaches you to fight any fear you've got, Just go through it, and then you're out the other side. You're not scared of it anymore, he says. Asked where his instinct for making people laugh began, and he goes straight back to childhood. He once said his greatest joy growing up was making his mum laugh, and that still feels true, even though she died more than a quarter of a century ago. It was an important part of my life because my mum, she suffered from depression a lot. So that was my main thing, if I could just go and cheer her up, really. These days, his own family are understandably harder to impress. As you get older and you get your own family, they don't look at it the same way. They go, oh God, Dad's off again. They don't have the same lust for my life. Let's say my kind of thing, he laughs. Although Norfolk is his home now, Kent still tugs at him. I was down there for the best part of 30 years, he says. Whitstable was a favourite haunt. I used to go to Whitstable all the time. I love Whitstable and also used to go there and get oysters very cheaply. For all the busy schedule and physical graft, he insists he doesn't really relax. I keep active all the time, he says. At 65, the aches are real. At a certain age, your body starts to say, I ache everywhere. But if I didn't go to the gym and do the things I do, I would ache a lot more than that. As dancers say, use it or lose it. If you don't use those muscles, they'll go and they'll never get it back. So he trains, cooks, flies and keeps saying yes to new projects. This year, that includes a trip to Edinburgh Festival to appear in 11 and a Half Angry Men, a comedy riff on the classic courtroom drama 12 Angry Men, followed by a month on the road with comedy pals Brian Connolly, Bradley Walsh and Shane Ritchie before Pancho season returns. By the time Christmas rolls around and the curtains open in Dartford, he'll have a lot of miles and laughs behind him. But he's not one for worrying about what's next. Asked how he manages his own stresses when his job is helping other people forget theirs, he comes back with something simple. I think it's getting old, he says. You actually learn to just go. Every day above the ground is a good day. That article by Katie Pearson is taken from the Norfolk Magazine of August 2026.
And to finish this week's supplement, experience the thrill of the Speedway. I think you can argue Norfolk is the most beautiful county in the UK. Okay, so there are no mountains. The Beeston Bump is about the best we can do on that score. But our county is just lovely. I go on about this all the time. The Broads, the beaches, the quiet country lanes, and Norfolk's general life-enhancing brilliance. Not too over the top, I hope. But this month, I want to start by talking about an industrial estate in King's Lynn. And, brace yourself for this, a more unlovely place it would be hard to find. I don't wish to be unkind, and before the owners of the Saddlebow Industrial Estate get upset, I know it's there to do a job, which it undoubtedly does very well. The reason I mentioned Saddlebow is because I have been going there for more than 30 years to visit what is now known as the Adrian Flux Arena, home of the King's Lynn Stars Speedway team. And what a place. Go there on a race night and you will find noise, grime, greasy burgers. And although it wouldn't be for everyone, it is for me. There are two astonishing facts about Speedway. The bikes can accelerate from 0 to 60 miles an hour in about 3 seconds. Scary. If that wasn't bad enough, they don't have brakes. I first came across Speedway when I started work in the early 1980s. I reported on the now defunct Coventry Bees, and I was fascinated by a sport that received little media attention but existed happily on its own terms. Speedway enjoyed its best years in the 1950s, when post-war Brits, way before smartphones and social media, got their kicks by watching men in leather risk their necks by whizzing round and round on funny-looking motorbikes. Crowds of up to 15,000 would flock to the Furs in Norwich to watch heroes like Ove Fundin in action. Sadly, the crowds began to drift away as the entertainment options increased in the 1960s and 70s. Today, there are just six clubs left in the Premiership, including the Ipswich Witches, last year's champions, and the King's Lynn Stars. So, how long can Speedway survive? Well, that question has been around for donkey's years. In 1998, I made a documentary for the BBC about Speedway called Bikes Without Brakes. It's worth pointing out again at this juncture that Speedway bikes are lightning fast, but for some reason, they don't have any brakes. The documentary was about the state of the sport and featured King's Lynn. My boss at the time wanted a news angle about finances, which didn't really exist, and I wanted a more character-driven study. For that reason, I featured the great Ove Fundin. A Swede, he won the world title five times when riding for Norwich in the 1950s. Quietly spoken, Fundin was generous with his time and was a joy to interview. By the way, someone managed to upload the documentary to YouTube. I watched it back a while ago, and it's not a bad little film. This month, football's World Cup will be in full cry, hoovering up hours and hours of our attention. Who knows? England might even win the thing this time. Wimbledon will also be on our screens. And the one sport which won't get much media attention is Speedway. But I'm not sure it cares much, frankly. I haven't been to a meeting for a while, and it's time I went back. The bikes are loud and they kick up the shale, which leaves you covered in a thin film of grime. But that's all part of the fun. So why not give it a try? At £25 for an adult ticket, it's not exactly cheap to get in. But fans argue it's an evening's entertainment. And I'd argue there's nothing quite like Speedway at King's Lynn. And that item by Mike Liggins is taken from the July 2026 issue of the Norfolk Magazine. Our thanks go to the editors and contributors of the Norfolk Magazine for permission to use their material.
We now finish with our last selection of news and views, starting with End of an Era as the traditional bakery owners announce their retirement. A traditional bakery on the North Norfolk coast is marking the end of an era as its owners head into retirement. Dudley's Bakery on Tucker Street in Cromer, owned by Sharon and Gary Dudley, has served the community for 19 years, with freshly baked bread, pies, pastries and sweet treats all made daily at the premises. Their business has now been put up for sale. Mrs. Dudley, 55, said, "Gary was a baker when I first met him. It has always been his dream to own his own bakery. It is something we have always wanted to do together, and we have really enjoyed it and enjoyed running our own business." Mr. Dudley, 63, has been working as a baker since he was just 12, and he has been chefing and baking for 52 years. His wife said, "My husband is coming up to 64 next year. We both feel that we are getting quite old, and it's getting to the stage where we are both thinking we need to have our retirement." The couple moved to Cromer in 1997 after getting married. This is the second bakery they have owned, having bought their first from a couple in their 60s. Mrs. Dudley said she hopes someone younger and energetic will take over the business and bring it into the digital age. I hope they modernise it to a certain degree and put it on social media because they will be a bit more tech savvy, she said. I think it would be good for business if it was promoted online, and it would be nice if they could attract different audience and bring in new customers. The bakery, which trades Monday to Saturday from 7am to 2:30pm, is being put on the market for £40,000. The couple plan to remain in Cromer and spend more time enjoying the countryside and travelling.
A bride and groom made an unexpected splash on their wedding day after falling into a river during a photo shoot. Jamie and Michelle Wade from Horsted were posing for photos along the River Bure when they climbed into a canoe and lost their balance, toppling into the water. "We went down like the Titanic," Mrs. Wade, a phlebotomist, said. "I can just remember, as we were sinking, thinking, I can't go in. I've got a wedding dress on. I've had my hair done." "We like the River Bure, but I never thought I'd end up in it. Not exactly the elegant newlywed photo we had imagined, but somehow it sums up our day perfectly. Completely unexpected, slightly chaotic, soaking wet, absolutely hilarious, and filled with love." The couple, both 46, said the mishap was just one of several that marked their eventful day on August the 29th. They first met at school in 1993 and reconnected in a Tesco car park in 2016. Mr. Wade, a builder, said, "I'd moved back to Norfolk and went to Tesco one day when I saw Michelle walking through the car park. I had that panic moment that comes from childhood dreams, and I thought, if I don't talk to her now, I never will again." They got engaged in May 2021, fittingly, on a boat. Their wedding at Norwich Castle included other mishaps, including forgotten flowers and confetti that stuck to guests in the rain. After their ceremony, they held their reception at the King's Head in Coltishall, before heading to nearby Coltishall Common for their photos. "All morning we thought the weather looked okay, and then suddenly rain, thunder, everything," Mrs. Wade added. "Our photographer told us we weren't going to get our sunset picture, but we knew we had to get creative. I'd waited since I was 13 for this moment."
An acclaimed author is set to share stories drawn from nearly a decade of life in rural Norfolk. Louis de Bernier, best known for the wartime romance novel Captain Corelli's Mandolin, will appear at Sheringham Little Theatre on Saturday, October the 3rd. He will be discussing his latest work, Smelling of Rooks, a collection of observations spanning 9 years. Described as an accidental memoir, the book offers candid reflections on everyday life in Norfolk, covering topics from music and motorcycles to parenting and social media. Chris Hamilton Emery, owner of Cromer-based Salt Publishing, said the book is drawn from Louis' hugely popular Facebook posts written between 2015 and 2024. It is about ordinary days told with the warmth, eccentricity and mischief that have made de Bernier one of Britain's most beloved storytellers. He described the book as a candid comic portrait of a writer's life in rural Norfolk, filled with stories about family, neighbours, cooking and the unpredictable joys of country living. Debbie Thompson, director of Sheringham Little Theatre, said, "We are thrilled Louis had chosen to make his first appearance at the Little Theatre to talk about his new book in a fundraising event to help our ongoing need to replace and update equipment. The evening will also include an audience Q&A and a conversation with Mr. Hamilton Emery. Earlier in the day, the theatre will screen the film adaptation of Captain Corelli's Mandolin at 3:30pm. Tickets for the film are priced at £6, while the In Conversation event costs £11. A bundle ticket for both events, which includes a Greek snack of olives, pita, hummus and a sweet treat, is available for £15. Bookings can be made through the theatre's website at www.sheringhamlittletheatre.com or by calling the box office on 01263 822 347.
A rail station has been recognised for its work in supporting nature and wildlife. Sheringham Station has been awarded Wildlife Friendly accreditation under the Greater Anglia Wildlife Friendly Stations Accreditation Scheme, which celebrates efforts to boost biodiversity across the rail network. Volunteer station adopter Sheila McGinley has spent the past 6 years creating a secret wildlife garden in a disused area beside the platform, filled with foxgloves, hollyhocks, geraniums and ivy. The garden can be viewed through the slatted platform fencing and provides a peaceful haven for pollinators and other wildlife. The scheme is a partnership between Greater Anglia and Regional Wildlife T Equals Trusts, designed to recognise the efforts of volunteer station adopters in creating wildlife habitats. Each assessment offers practical advice to further improve the stations for wildlife. James Hogg, Development Officer at the Norfolk Wildlife Trust, said, "This project with Greater Anglia, now in its fifth year, is a fantastic example of how people can transform nature poor areas into new nature-rich places and change the way we think about land-seizing opportunities to help nature outside traditional nature reserves." As the Norfolk Wildlife Trust celebrates its 100th year, it's encouraging to see initiatives like this that show just how much is being done to reverse the decline of our wildlife populations. Alan Neville, Customer and Community Engagement Manager at Greater Anglia, said, "We are delighted to partner with the region's Wildlife Trust to formally recognise the valuable work of our station adopter volunteers in supporting wildlife and improving their local environment. Across East Anglia, more than 340 volunteers last year transformed over 10,000 square metres of land into wildlife gardens. In a recent survey, Greater Anglia station adopters reported sightings of many different types of butterflies, as well as bees, slowworms, bats, foxes, toads, lizards, deer, and many varieties of birds visiting their stations."
And that brings us to the end of this edition of The Mardler, with readings from the North Norfolk News. If you have any comments or queries, our listener liaison officer is Imogen Waterson on 01263 587 610. If you have a smartphone, tablet or computer, or know someone who has, you can listen to this and other editions online at mardler.org.uk. You can also use an Alexa smart speaker to listen using the Talking Newspaper skill. Find out the details on our website, mardler.org.uk. But please, when returning the pouch and the memory stick, remember to reverse the label. The sound engineer this week was David Mitchell, and the editor-producer was David Audley. And our colleagues in the copying and dispatch room join us in thanking you for listening and wishing you a week to remember. And we look forward to joining you again next Friday. But for now, though, from today's readers, it's cheerio!